Our first reading today is from perhaps an unlikely source for a Sunday morning, the book Made to Stick, Why Some Ideas Survive and Others Die, by brothers Chip and Dan Heath.
Art Silverman stared at a bag of movie popcorn. It looked out of place sitting on his desk. His office had long since filled with fake butter fumes. Silverman knew, because of his organization's research, that the popcorn on his desk was unhealthy. Shockingly unhealthy, in fact. His job was to figure out a way to communicate this message to the unsuspecting moviegoer. Silverman worked for the Center for Science in the Public Interest, a nonprofit group that educates the public about nutrition. And CPSI sent bags of movie popcorn from a dozen theaters in three major cities to a lab for nutritional analysis. The results were surprising to everyone. The U.S. Department of Agriculture recommends that a normal diet contain no more than 20 grams of saturated fat each day. According to this lab results, the typical bag of popcorn had 37 grams of fat. And those 37 grams were packed into a medium-sized serving. The challenge, Silverman realized, was that few people know what 37 grams of saturated fat means. Most of us do not memorize the USDA's daily nutrition recommendations. Is 37 grams good or bad? Or even if we have an intuition that it's bad, we'd wonder if it was bad, like cigarettes, or normal bad, like cookies or milkshakes. Even the phrase 37 grams of saturated fat by itself was enough to cause most people's eyes to glaze over. Saturated fat has zero appeal, Silverman says. It's dry, it's academic, who cares? Silverman could have created some kind of visual comparison, perhaps an advertising comparing the amount of saturated fat in the popcorn with the USDA's recommended daily allowance. But that too was too scientific, too rational. The amount of fat in this popcorn was, in some sense, rational. It was not rational. It was ludicrous. The CPSI needed a way to shape the message in a way that fully communicated this ludicrousness. Silverman came up with the solution. The CPSI called a press conference on September 27th, 1992, And here's the message it presented. A medium-sized butter popcorn at a typical neighborhood theater contains more artery-clogging fat than a bacon and eggs breakfast, a Big Mac and fries for lunch, a steak dinner with all of the trimmings at dinner time, and all of these combined. The message was an immediate sensation. The idea held.
The second reading today is from the essay titled Fences Against Freedom by Leslie Marmon Silko in her collection Yellow Woman and a Beauty of the Spirit, Essays on Native American Life Today. Silko is a U.S. citizen and Laguna Indian living now in Tucson, Arizona. Here she writes about traveling with a companion home from a book signing in Albuquerque in 1992. A caveat. I've chosen this reading not in support of or judgment of any medical use of a controlled substance. You'll understand why I say that later. But to show that expressions of dignity come in many forms. The reading begins. There are no border patrol detention areas on the southbound lanes of I-25. So I settled back and went to sleep while Gus drove. I awakened when I felt the car slowing to a stop. It was nearly midnight on New Mexico State Road 26, a dark, lonely stretch of two-lane highway between Hatch and Deming. When I sat up, I saw the headlights and emergency flashers of six vehicles, Border Patrol cars and one van. They blocked the road. Gus stopped the car and rolled down the window to ask what was wrong, but the border patrolman and his companions did not reply. Instead, the officer ordered us to get out of the car. Gus asked why, and his question seemed to set them off. Two more border patrolmen immediately approached the car, and one of them asked, "Are you looking for trouble?" I will never forget that night beside the highway. There was an awful feeling of menace straining to break loose. We both got out of the car and they motioned for us to stand on the shoulder of the road. The night was dark and no other traffic had come down the road since they had stopped us. The man who asked if we were looking for trouble told his partner to get the dog. And from the back of the van, another border patrolman brought us out a small female German shepherd. The dog did not heel well enough to suit him, and I saw the dog's handler jerk the leash. They opened the doors of our car and pulled the dog's head inside. But I saw immediately from the expression in her eyes that the dog hated them and would not serve them. When she showed no interest in the inside of the car, they brought her around back to the trunk, near where we were standing. They half-dragged her up into the trunk, but still she did not indicate stowed away humans or illegal drugs. Their mood got uglier. They seemed outraged that the dog could not find any contraband, and they dragged her over to us and commanded her to sniff our legs and feet. We exchanged looks, the dog and I. She was afraid of what they might do, just as I was. The handler jerked the leash as she sniffed us, as if to make her perform better. But the dog refused to accuse us. The dog had an innate dignity and integrity that did not permit her to serve those men. I had a small amount of medical marijuana in my purse that night. But the dog refused to expose me. I am not partial to dogs, Silco concludes, but I can't forget the small German shepherd. She saved us that night. Thank you, Nathan. I'm looking at the clock. I have been known to take a 20-minute sermon and whittle it down to 7. I'm not going to do that this morning. So get comfortable. Beginning in the 1970s and continuing through last fall, the ministers in our faith tradition have met every several years in what we call a convocation, convo for short. As it turns out, a convo was to take place in my last term during seminary. I had to go. And as I got there at the end of our time in line for our closing worship, I was asked to light the chalice. Not a difficult task. Our youth do it every Sunday, twice. But there I stood in front of nearly 500, hopefully, future colleagues, and my arm would not stop shaking. What no one in the hall knew, with the exception of my roommate, was that earlier that morning I had suffered a theological near miss, which is admittedly highfalutin language for a really embarrassing situation. And I may be overstating it, but I think you'll see what I mean in just a moment. In order not to completely break the bank, my roommate Tom and I had settled on a hotel, about a 5-10 minute walk from the hotel where the convo was taking place. But there were few others staying there at the time. Every morning when we went down for our complimentary breakfast, it was as if we had the whole place to ourselves. And as luck would have it, we had the same waitress every morning. Yes, waitress. This was no Comfort Inn breakfast bar. This was a real breakfast. We were in Hot Springs, Arkansas. And while the place was only a shadow of what it must have been back in its heyday, they were not going to skimp on the Southern hospitality. Because the waitress had been so good to us that week, Tom and I wanted to go out of our way to thank her on our last morning before we checked out. "Well, what are you boys here for anyway?" she asked. Bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, "We're part of a gathering of Unitarian Universalist ministers, ma'am," we answered. "You know what?" "Never heard of it. What do you all believe in?" Her response may be familiar to those of you who have been in our faith tradition for a while. In response, we, being earnest, fired-up seminarians, proceeded to pull out our battered UU wallet cards and, which I forgot to bring with me, but it's battered and it's in my wallet, and dutifully list off the principles and purposes of the Unitarian Universalist denomination. We affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and the compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and society at large, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. And finally, a respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are all a part. I don't remember just how far down the list we got that morning. At about the word relations, her eyes started glazing over. I'd like to say we stopped right there, but we may have gone on a little bit. You've probably known that clergy have a way of doing that, and we were learning the trade, taking that to heart. But the waitress was nothing if not polite. She heard us out, and then she asked, "Well, I don't know all about that, but let me ask you this. Do you boys pray?" "Yes, of course," we stretched the truth a little bit, not wanting to lose her completely. And then her eyes turned both serious and sad. "My son," she said, "he's 15 and he's going through a hard time, a real hard time. His name is Ben. Would you pray for him?" "Yes, ma'am." And we did. As we were walking to the convo site for the worship, my mind went back to a little story I had heard somewhere concerning a young boy frightened by a storm raging outside his window. Not able to sleep, he goes to his father for comfort. "It's okay, son. You'll be fine. Go back to bed now." But the boy is still frightened. He returns to his father's bedside. "Just close your eyes, son, and pray to God. He'll protect you." After a while, the boy returns once more, perhaps a bit less afraid, but still not satisfied. "Daddy, God's a help, I guess, but could you tell him to put some skin on?" What Tom and I had given our waitress was to describe only the skeleton of our faith tradition. What she wanted, what she needed, wasn't bones, but a faith with some skin on. Hers was not a childish need, but the need born of a mother's love and desire to protect her child. And the words that I first had for her left her cold. I was missing something. So over the years, I've listened carefully as we, as a denomination, have talked about elevator speeches, those snippets of explanation we might offer someone sharing an elevator with us, who notices we may have a Unitarian Universalist pin and asks what that's about. Those elevator speeches are what we would say in response about the nature of our faith and the time it takes the elevator to go from the fourth to the ground floor. I've also paid attention of how we put ourselves out there in the wider public. Back in the 50s, the Unitarians had a sleeper hit with an ad campaign that asked, are you a Unitarian without knowing it? Years later, we were still hearing echoes of that question. Those of you who were around will remember, those of you who were here then will remember the news that on Sunday morning, July 28th, 2008, not quite 2 years ago now, an angry and lonely man carried a shotgun into our congregation in Knoxville, Tennessee, during a youth pageant. He killed 2 adults and injured 6 others before he was subdued. I skipped more than I meant to, I was talking about, in recent years, we came up with an ad campaign. You may have seen the ads in Time magazine. You may have seen the bumper stickers. I've seen at least one of the t-shirts here. Unitarian Universalism, the uncommon denomination. Well, that got some play. It worked better with people outside the faith than inside the faith. And then Knoxville happened. And all of a sudden, it felt like an empty chalice. A chalice with no flame or nothing to drink. And then in the aftermath of Knoxville, the uncommon denomination slogan rang hollow. Alliteration and cleverness were not enough. So we looked around for something that would speak for us in all times, good times and bad times both. And we found we had it with us all along. In 2004, the team charged with coming up with a new hymnal supplement was meeting in Boston when President Bush in Washington called for a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. Many of us here in Ohio and California and Massachusetts, all over the country, had been working to promote marriage equality. And we're going to speak out at this. In his remarks, Bill Sinkford, then president of our denomination, said that we stand on the side of love. At the meeting in Boston, Jason Shelton, associate minister of music at our church in Nashville, was there, and listening to his comments, he wrote down Sinkford's phrase. And then he kept on writing. That Sunday, he led his choir in singing the song he had just composed, the song you sang earlier. The song became a minor anthem of sorts in our efforts for marriage equality, and the phrase around which it is built is both a fair, if brief, summary of our theology and approach to lives of faith. On the Standing on the Side of Love website, you can find these words by poet Sonia Sanchez. Zora Neale Thurston said that fear is the greatest emotion. And I said, no, my dear sister. Fear will make us move to save our own skins. Love also makes us save ourselves, but it will make us move to save others as well. In the aftermath of yet another tragedy, a call for hope and action was found, and a new campaign was given birth. Standing on the Side of Love is a public advocacy program that seeks to harness love's power to stop oppression and to promote beauty and justice, as I said earlier. But it's an unusual campaign in at least one respect. While it has focused on marriage equality and is now being used to promote open and thorough discussion on the need for immigration reform, you didn't think I chose that second reading just on a whim, did you? The campaign is also intentionally open-ended. Standing on the Side of Love is a banner which we can also use to promote what we are already doing or wish to start doing here locally. Some have objected to what they see as the slogan's arrogance. We stand on the side of love and not others? No, no, of course. We're not the only ones with a handle on love. But love is the most trustworthy way we know to move forward into blessed community. And what better motivator is there than love? We can argue about the ways and means of justice, the ways and means of any single policy. But who wants to argue with love? And so we have this flashy new heart logo on the cover of your orders of service, and it's up there if you can see it. It's on the shirts and on the back. And we have the brightest t-shirts known to humankind. And if you go to standingonthesideoflove.org, you'll find a link to an article about the demonstration at Ohio Wesleyan a week and a half ago. In response to a threatened protest, and I wrote about this in my newsletter column for those of you who are reading, In response to a threatened protest by the Westboro Baptist Church to a screening of the documentary The Anatomy of Hate about hate speech at Ohio Wesleyan, campus groups called for a love day on the J, a love day on their quad, their gathering place. And we were there to stand with them. There's even a picture on the site of our members holding up a huge goldenrod standing on the Side of Love banner. And if you look closely, it's going to be too far away for you to see on the t-shirts, but if you come up and look at them, you'll notice something you might realize is missing or think is missing. And those are the words Unitarian Universalist. The goal is for the tools of this campaign, the t-shirts, the banners, I forgot to bring my bumper sticker here. The goal is for us to be able to use them and give them to folks from other faith traditions as well. We know we're not the only ones standing on the side of love. And we know we make a stronger case when we're all standing together. One of the best answers I've ever heard to the question of what is worth considering sacred are truths that have withstood the test of time. And as we know, in our media-saturated culture, slogans have about as much staying power as the Chicago Cubs do in a pennant race. So what I've been hoping for ever since that morning's conversation with the waitress in Arkansas is a message about our faith that has deep roots and also is sticky, one that will capture people's attention, one that will be memorable. And for my money, standing on the side of love does that, at least for now, at least for now. As Meg Riley said a few weeks ago at our district's annual assembly, love is the strongest force in the world, but only if we choose to use it. When we choose to use it. On the evening of May 3rd, 2 weeks and a day from today, I'll make my choice and put on a goldenrod t-shirt. When I join hopefully upwards of 300 of you at the Nehemiah Action at Vets Memorial Auditorium, as Earl alluded to earlier in the announcement for Bread. Those who were here a few weeks ago saw a skit about this year's Bread campaign and laughed along with me at a humorous depiction of a very serious problem. Each autumn, the member faith communities that comprise Bread hold house meetings at which we ask one another, what are the concerns we have for our community that keep us up at night? This year, the problem that rose to the top once again was the fact that we're failing our youth. As the skit made clear, there is an all-too-present school-to-prison pipeline, even here in Columbus. Kids are out on the streets when they should be in school. We have to find ways to engage them and provide punishments for behavior that warrants it inside the school system rather than releasing them out to the streets where the presence of gangs is on the rise. When, contrary to their own policy, administrators of our schools hand out over 4,200 out-of-school suspensions for truancy, telling the kids, in effect, you're not coming to school, so hey, you can't come to school, so there. That means we're giving up on them. That means we're giving up on them. And when you notice that, you know that we have a real problem on our hands. But you also notice you have a handle to address the larger concern of how we give our youth the support they need. We've invited Columbus School Superintendent Dr. Jean Harris to be with us on May 3rd. We're asking her to do three things to keep the schools to follow their own policies, to help us expand a successful truancy program, and to join us in finding other ways to keep the kids in school even when they need to be disciplined. These aren't earth-shattering requests, but they can be life-changing ones. We're white churches, we're black churches, we're synagogues and mosques, we're people the school district would want, should want on its side. Love takes many forms, but love does not give up. Love keeps an open door and does not leave our children to the streets. Love does let go when it needs to, but not in cases like this. Love does not allow us to forsake our youth. So please join me on May 3rd. We need to pack Vets Memorial Auditorium to get the attention of Dr. Harris, the school board, and the city. We are failing our youth. Together we can make a stand for them, lest we forget that their future is our own. Please join me in the adventure of standing on the side of love. Thank you.